Lunch with Leon.
And welcome to another episode of Lunch with Leon. Now, look, you might have noticed episodes are coming through a bit more frequently in the last few weeks. Look, this is not a change in policy, but we've had some amazing guests, all of whom are really busy people, and I just have to grab their time when they're available. Now, I could store them all up, but actually things in the world now change so quickly. If you don't get the episodes out quite quickly, sometimes the references become outdated. So I've been getting them out at a faster rate. The great team at Stark Communications have been helping with all the preparation work and getting the episodes out to all the media. That makes my job a bit easier. However, the guests and the conversations are all mine. And if you like them, please do send a review and a rating on your podcast platform. That helps spread the word. This episode, a great welcome to my friend Sophie Bancroft, who is HR Director at Network Rail, having been in many operations roles there and at TfL. Sophie's career has been exceptional, and I started out by asking her whether she felt she was helped by the TfL Graduate Management Scheme, arguably one of the best graduate schemes in the country.
It's absolutely incredible. September 2008, I started, which is brilliant. I remember applying. I didn't quite know what I wanted to do. It's like the classic railway story. Didn't know what you wanted to do. I wanted to work in London. I wanted to work for a big company. And TfL offered the most choice, actually. I joined as a London Underground management graduate, and I loved it. It was 2 years of doing absolutely everything. And I remember one of the directors at the time said to me, use this opportunity to do jobs that you don't think you actually want to do, because it's the only time in your career you can try things for about sort of 3 to 6 months. Yeah. And it's okay if you don't like it, but you know then that's a department that you know about, that you've met people and kind of confirmed that, yeah, that's not for me, and that's okay. I loved it.
Well, I always thought that it was one of the best schemes. What also fascinated me, because I used to do graduate recruitment interviews, as you might remember, when we were together in TfL, and what was interesting, well, the number of people who came because they didn't really know anything at all about transport but thought they ought to come. When they did come, they really were mainly thinking about the underground and weren't much thinking about anything else. And then during the course of the interview, you saw people just suddenly brighten up because they realized, instead of this just being another graduate recruitment interview, because they had to do a certain number of them and they were hoping to go and work for a record company or a chemicals company or something overseas, they suddenly realized the great opportunities inside TfL on all sides of it, and whether it was engineering or operations, whether it was computer stuff, accountancy, the whole range of stuff was there. And you saw people really change during the interviews. And as I say, probably one of the best graduate recruitment schemes. As you know, we had Peter Hendy as a guest on the show a couple of episodes back. He himself, a product of the London Transport Graduate Recruitment Scheme. He in his time was a conductor on Route 11 and probably the worst bus inspector at Archway Station the organisation ever had. And look what happened to him. He's now the minister in Her Majesty's government. So isn't that great?
Well, exactly. And I think there's so many people who I've kind of got to know who said, oh, yes, I started out with the graduate scheme at TfL. And I've also made real lifelong friends. So I've got a WhatsApp group of friends who work at Network Rail and sort of some of the talks. And we all started out together on the grad scheme. I met my husband in the first week of the grad scheme. A friend of mine, Emily, is godmother to my son. Like it's I've made some really lovely friends, and I totally fell in love with operations whilst working at TfL. So I always had a bit of a love of heritage railways and steam trains, and perhaps we'll come on to that a bit later. But I think as one of the wonderful things about the graduate scheme is we had to do operational placements. And it didn't matter whether you were going into accountancy or legal or project management, we all had to do some sort of operational placement. And I just thought it was the best grounding for working in the railway industry, because we all had to learn how to be station supervisors. And I think there's nothing more grounding than sort of working at Oxford Circus or Piccadilly Circus on a Saturday night at whatever time, pre-night tube, trying to close the station, keep everyone safe. And it was just so interesting. And that's where I really realized how much I loved working in kind of the fast-paced operational sphere. I knew I liked the railway, but I didn't realize quite how much of like a vocation it would become. And it was, I loved it.
And look what it's done for you since, catapulted you through Fantastic jobs into where you are now in Network Rail.
Yes.
So, rail reform then.
Yes.
What's the mood like since you're the HR person? What's the mood like? Are people optimistic about rail reform?
So it's very, very interesting. I think yes, I think we are. Everyone is quite optimistic. I think as Peter said in his kind of conversation and recently sort of in some magazine articles, like it's been coming for a long time. We've been needing reform for a long time. And I think that as the government sort of produces more documents, we get more sort of certainty on what it is that we're working towards. And I think we are quite, I think there is an optimism of looking at how we can bring the best of Network Rail and the private sector together to kind of really work for all the customers that use the railway, sort of passengers, freight, everyone together.
No, I think so. I mean, the trouble is all change brings uncertainty, and that's part of your job, of course. But change is continuous anyway now. Anybody who thinks things shouldn't change is living in a different era.
Absolutely. Like change happens every single day. Like sort of we all get older every day. Like you can't avoid change. I think it's about the mindset from which you approach it. So I've always got new jobs out of change programs throughout my career. Kind of I've been involved in lots of different change programs, and always tried to keep the positive. My wonderful father always said, spheres of influence, spheres of control. So control what you can, influence what you can, and the rest of it don't worry about. And so I can't. And I would kind of say that to everyone. I instill it in my children now. It's the what you can control, control. So I can control doing the best job I can and working as hard as I can, doing the best I can. But I can't control lots of things, so I can't worry about it. And I think that's the same for everyone, is that we all have to understand that the industry is changing, the customer patterns are changing, and it's how do we best respond to that? Because if we don't respond to it correctly, then we won't have an industry.
Indeed. The other thing that worries me a bit, of course, is that the great British public also seems to think that changing the ownership and structure of the railways will magically change the laws of economics. But actually, the staff will still want paying, the infrastructure will still need building and maintaining, energy will
Yes.
still be energy, and there isn't a sort of magic wave of the wand that is miraculously going to make everything twice as efficient, half as expensive, and fares go down. I mean, that's really unrealistic, isn't it?
I think it is unrealistic. Like we've still got, there's still a large proportion of people working on a very big system that ultimately wasn't built to integrate with each other. And I think people often forget that. And I think that what change will do is it will hopefully reduce bureaucracy and take away some of the sort of the contractual steps that sort of tie people in knots at the moment. But you're right, it's not going to dramatically reduce everything overnight, but there's steps to take, and I think it's all about a plan. It's a plan and a way forward, I think, is the benefit.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly detect, a little bit like I did in the run-up to the general election, the public is ready for a change. And sometimes, as you know in your world, sometimes you have to have a change, even if it's not always the right thing. You have to have a change because the change itself causes you to lift up the floorboards, have a poke about underneath, shine a light in some dark corners. And sometimes on the public side, they want to know there's a change coming down because that's their reason for optimism. So
Yes.
I think we're giving the public optimism. The government's got a tricky job, I think, and Peter's got a tricky job in making sure
Yes.
that the public doesn't think that overnight, as the first rail franchises come back into public ownership, that there'll be magic changes on the network because it'll still be the same folk with the same equipment doing the same job.
Yes, it will be, and that's absolutely true. But I think that by lifting up the sort of the bonnet, so to speak, of lots of different areas, we can get, I want to get the very best out of the railway industry. There's a huge amount of people who work so hard, and I think one of the best things about working in the industry is the passion that people have and the pride that people have in their job, and we just really need to harness that. And I think there's something around, we can use this change to really empower people. So sort of all the drivers, the signalers, the guards, the infrastructure teams, like we can empower them to make the right decisions for their areas, and I think that will drive huge efficiencies just because people will be empowered to make decisions for their area.
Yeah. The thing I've always believed in is that broadly, employees want to do a good job and will try very hard to do a good job. until they notice that other people are getting away with not doing such a good job. And then their own performance can start to fade away, because why would you continue to try very, very hard when other people in the system don't seem to be working as hard as you are, and therefore, it's quite hard to keep a high level of performance up if you're not, if it's not happening with colleagues around the network. And I always think it's a great pity that, if you like, we don't act on that much more expeditiously, because I'm sure inherently in the workforce at large, it wants to do a really good job if it can.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with that actually, because I think that's about personal mindset and personal motivation. And that if others around you aren't shirking their responsibilities and aren't working as hard as you are, then that's your opportunity to shine and show that you're not someone who just gives up and doesn't sort of does the bare minimum. And that's your opportunity to show the best that you can be. And I think there's also a lot that goes on that people don't see. So if someone is being managed, you can't talk about it. You're not going to go and put a notice up in the mess room and say, oh, Sophie's being performance managed because she's awful. And so I think that you kind of have to, kind of going back to spheres of control, you have to focus on you. You can't worry about what other people are doing or not doing. And actually, it's the pride that each person takes is that's important, not what everyone else is doing or not doing or perceived to be getting away with. Because also, you don't know what's going on in people's lives. You don't know if what perceived to be their bare minimum is actually the absolute best that they're doing at that moment. And so I think that just focus on what it is that you personally can do.
Yes, the one I always notice, which is when I can tell the difference between somebody who's motivated and somebody who's not, is when it spills over into the public arena. So when an employee in any organization effectively says to the customer, I don't know anything what's going on here. Nobody tells me anything.
Oh,
This
yeah.
never works. And effectively they're unloading on the customer their own frustration. And the one I always love to see, and of course I see that much more often than what I've just described, is where the people grow big shoulders and say, I'm sorry about this disruption. We're still trying to find out what's happening. I will try and keep you up to date. In the meantime, please bear with us. Because they haven't unloaded the problem and said, it's not my fault, it's somebody else's. They've grown big shoulders and they're now acting on behalf of the organization in a way that really outweighs their pay grade and all the rest of it, because they're broadly saying, I'm an official in this organization. I'm taking responsibility for it. My job is to keep you advised. And there we are. And when I see that, that's always a commendation for me, because
I agree.
I always think that's really good, and let's hope we see more of it on the network. There was a couple other things I wanted to talk to you about. So you would have been on the Metropolitan line during the Olympics, I
Yes,
guess.
oh, I was. So
Well,
the
wasn't that a
Metropolitan
wonderful
Line,
time?
oh, it was absolutely brilliant. The Met Line holds the most special place in my heart of railways. It really does. I spent a few years working on the Met in lots of different jobs. So, yeah, so I was service control manager for the Metropolitan Line during the Olympics, and it was just brilliant. I just can't remember a time where, I mean, the railway worked so incredibly well, and it was just so happy, and I really loved the it was a really small thing, but I loved that the where we could on the underground, we put sort of medal information up on the display boards, and so you'd sort of be going around the tube and you'd be like, oh, so and so's won a gold, and we're like, oh, that's so exciting, sort
It's
of
tremendous.
updates would go on. It was so good, and it just the planning that went in.
Yes.
I know you were in like integral to that, like, but I think that
Well,
the planning that we did was just insane.
yeah, there were some clever things. One was getting ahead of the maintenance, so we didn't
Yes.
have any unexpected problems during the course of the game. So we got on the front foot with the maintenance so that we didn't need any possessions and we didn't need any temperature
No.
restrictions during the games itself. That was fabulous. And same on the roads. We pushed ahead on road maintenance and activities just to make sure that there weren't any roadworks. And I know somebody's going to call in and say, but I remember travelling into London and there were roadworks. Well, they were just pretend roadworks, because that was just us constraining the speed at which traffic could arrive in the centre of London. So where we couldn't control it with traffic signals, we put up cones and pretended we were working on the road, which we weren't.
I never knew that.
Yeah, there
That's
you go.
hilarious.
There's bits of road like the A40 where there's no traffic signals between Denham and Park Royal. There's no way to constrain the flow of traffic. So we did what we call lane drops. In fact, I got a complaint from David Cameron, of course, he used to commute on that. He said to me, you told me there wouldn't be any roadworks. And I said, yes, I did. So I'll have to level with you, Prime Minister. The truth is, we're inventing roadworks in order to hold the traffic back. Anyway, there's a story. Now everybody knows it now.
Now
Look at that.
everyone knows that. I love that. So I think that's another fascinating thing about working in the railway is the whole like sort of traffic demand management. It was a whole, I think once you kind of go into the industry, there's, you realize there's this whole world of jobs and sort of things that you never ever knew about. So the way we use how many gates you open at a station to control the number of people going in and out, the walking routes that we promote, the bus travel that we promote. And I think it's really clever. And I think it would be really cool to like shine a light on the sort of the work that we do. So it's sort of like putting in the fake roadworks to slow down the traffic and understanding how we could have at TfL, we sort of come together as an integrated body to like move people in the safest, best way possible. I think it's, and then now I find it, I'm quite sad, but I find it really interesting to look. So if there's like an event going on, I'll find it really interesting to look at the event plan of how people like are meant to walk around places. And I'd be like, oh, that's an interesting one. And I'll probably ignore it and use the sort of the quickest route that I can. But I find it really interesting when you see people kind of purposefully going on a big loop round somewhere. And I know that it's, that's all part of the traffic calming measures.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating, and as you will know, once you've worked on big events, you get bitten by it. And if you just go to a big event yourself as a civilian, you're watching how it is all managed and put together and so on. And for me, as I think I might have said previously in an episode, as I come out of the O2, and I'm watching 20,000 people heading for North Greenwich Station, and it's got to work. There's got to be a Jubilee Line train every 3 to 4 minutes. By the last train, in order to get everybody out, I of course have turned right and have walked down to the pier to get on Thames Clippers. But that's because I work with them as well. But to watch all that, and then the other one's fascinating. For years, like years and years and years, I worked on Notting Hill Carnival. And what's interesting, Carnival on the main day, on the Monday, is that it's still about the same number of people, which is like 750 to 800,000. But as the last people are arriving, the first people are leaving. That's in complete contrast. If you ever get the chance in July, Christopher Street Parade, which is the LGBT event in Berlin, everybody's in by 10 and they're there until 6, which means that during the middle part of the day, the transport's got no lifting to do. So you can stand the crews down,
Gosh.
they can have
Oh, that's
refreshments and so on.
glorious.
And same number of people, absolutely same number of people, except the whole in and out characteristics are different, which is fascinating when you work
That
on
is
big events.
interesting because because I've done a few Notting Hill carnivals and it is that just constant churn throughout the day. And I think what's interesting is moving to Network Rail and seeing it. So I was on working I was ops I am substantially ops director on Western Route and seeing the carnival from the Network Rail perspective was really interesting and kind of working with TfL from sort of the other side, so to speak,
Yes,
and sort of
I've.
how we man again manage the customers from all the different railways and stations and kind of really keep it going. So I remember being really overly excited when the SDOT came in, and I was standing at Wembley helping out on a football match. I can't remember what it was, a football match at Wembley, sort of helping on the station, doing some station stuff, and just really not believing the amount of people those trains can kind of like suck in and move really quickly. And it was just such a stark difference from the A stock. I was like, God, these trains are brilliant. And it was
Yes.
really it was quite, and I still very cool. I still get quite excited when I went to a few concerts in Wembley last summer. And I just remember being on the S stock being like, these trains are amazing with the amount of people we can move.
I know it is extraordinary, isn't it? And you do have to, the transport has to adapt to the public and not the other way around. The discussion I had with Boris in my very earliest time in TfL when he said, "I really want to move Notting Hill Carnival to Hyde Park." I said, "Well, let me tell you what will happen. The police and the toilets will be in Hyde Park, but a million other people will be in Ladbroke Grove because the event is where the people want it to be, because it's not a ticketed event, and therefore it's going to be where it is." Now, look, very exciting and so on. And then on the other place I was going to take us to, something that you and I worked on quite separately, which was the terrible accident at Sandilands on Croydon Tram. Me, of course, because it was in my era of responsibility for Croydon Tram. In November 16, because I picked up DLR trams and Overground at that time. And you, of course, worked on the inquest, all of which was a difficult time, wasn't it?
It was a very difficult time. So during the Sandilands inquest, I actually took over as general manager of London Trams to allow Mark Davis, who's the current general manager, to attend this inquest every day. And he was general manager during the accident. And so it was really important that he was there every day, and I think it was important for him as a person and him as a leader to be there. So I was asked to go and be the general manager of trams for 6 months. I hadn't worked in trams before. It was very difficult for the people I was leading because they had all been touched by the incident at some point, and it was lots of people was had sort of been to site, had been part of it. And it's a very close-knit group at trams. And so I was sort of playing the part of supporting them through this really difficult time and keeping the trams going, like the running of the system. So they were there was lots of work to be done. So it was sort of that fine line of keeping the trams going, leading people through a really difficult time, and also very conscious that this wasn't my job and I was just keeping it warm for Mark. And so Mark and I worked, it was actually really lovely working really closely with him. We kind of said any sort of short-term decisions just make, and anything that sort of would impact longer term, have a chat to him about it. Because I also didn't want him, I wanted him to know that the trams were in safe hands and he didn't have to worry. But actually the team I worked with at trams, the sort of Mark's management team, were absolutely fabulous and they were so supportive. And it was a really interesting time because everyone really looked out for each other. So it was also just, it was 2021. So it was sort of the aftermath of COVID. So it was some part lockdown, part not. So sort of it was also that bringing people back together. So lots of people hadn't been into the office for a long time. So it's working with that as well. So lots and lots of different things going on. But actually, I think it was that everyone worked with such kindness. And I think we all appreciated that it was a difficult time and everyone really treated each other with respect and kindness, which was lovely.
Yes, it is a great pity that it always requires a tragedy to remind people some of those
Yeah, it does.
behaviors and so on, which is, but it is one of the good things that come out of them, which is that people learn to be sensitive to each other, thoughtful to each other, supportive, and so on. And
Yeah.
as you rightly describe, it was a terrible period at trams. As you know, I was on the scene from about 7:30, which is about
Yeah.
only an hour or so after it had taken place, and it just was extraordinary to such an extent that all the people who were on site early were eventually offered counselling, because it's not something you necessarily run into as part of your ordinary operating
No,
experience.
I think
But
that's so important, is that we have to, in the industry, that we expect our people to see and to act in some circumstances that we would never generally see in like normal jobs or normal life. And I think the fact that, kind of, you said eventually people offered counselling, I think that's really, really positive, but it should be a first call now. So I know fatalities for drivers, we sort of have the trauma response groups, and I think that's really, really important that we are, as an industry, much better at looking after the emotional and mental side of these horrific accidents like
indeed.
Sandylands, but also the sort of the day-to-day accidents and awful things that happen on the railway.
No, it is interesting because on the roadside, there isn't anything like the plan for the support of staff, certainly bus drivers and so on.
Oh, interesting.
And in fact, it's something that Claire Mann has picked up since she's become chief operating officer, which is a real disparity between the support that's available to train drivers involved in fatalities and serious incidents and the support available to bus drivers. Of course, you know, one's direct employed labour and one is contracted out, and to some extent, it's a responsibility of the employer. But nevertheless, these people lost their lives on the network, and therefore,
Yes.
TfL has a prime responsibility for the welfare of all concerned, including the staff.
Gosh, that surprises me actually. I didn't know that. I think Claire is just fabulous as well.
Absolutely. She listens to this, so we can say she's fabulous
Hi,
several
Claire.
times.
No, Claire's absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
So I've got a brilliant story about Claire, actually. And I don't think she'll mind me saying this. I had recently returned from my second maternity leave and I was working on the Metropolitan Line. I was head of line operations, really enjoying it. I do love the Met Line. It's very special. But I wanted a change. I'd been doing TfL operations for, sorry, London Underground operations for a very long time. And I thought I need to do something else. And I'm also one for, I'm very big on diversity of thought. And I thought I need to expand my horizons as well and expand my sort of experience. And there was a head of bus operations working for Claire secondment going from covering a maternity leave. And I applied, having never worked in buses, I don't think I'd ever spoken to Claire before. And then my son, who was 16 months old at the time, became ill and he was totally fine, but it was like a high fever bug thing and had to have some time off nursery. My husband was a consultant at the time, so if he didn't go to work, he didn't get paid. And so I was the one sort of taking the time off work, and that's absolutely fine. Like, I was like, oh God, why? What am I doing starting a new job? But I don't know anyone. I don't know the job. I don't know the people. I've got a little boy and a 4-year-old girl at the time. I've got two children, both in nursery. Like, what am I doing? And so I withdrew. And Claire reached out, didn't know me. And she said, let's go for coffee. So I went to meet her for coffee, and she was director of buses. And she said, why did you pull out? And I was really honest. And I told her. She said, well, that was silly, wasn't it? And I was like, what? And she said, we're all people, and the best leaders are the ones that manage, that are kind of honest and open about what their needs are. Like, lots of people have children, lots of people have caring responsibilities, lots of people have stuff going on in their lives that means sometimes they have to go home and look after things in the middle of the day. And it's like, but actually, it's the work you do when you stay late 6 hours, 6 days later, or whatever. It's the work you do around that that means it's not, the railway isn't just, sorry, buses, but the industry isn't just a 9 to 5 thing. And that's one of the things I absolutely love about the industry, actually, that it's not 9 to 5. And she said, don't make that mistake again, and it, in a very kind way. So I was too late for that job. But then the head of surface business strategy, the comment came up on maternity leave, and I was like, right, I'm going for it. And I got it. And that's that. Without that job, I never would have had the trams opportunity, and I never would have got the operations director at Network Rail job without the experience of that strategy role. So everything really links back to that conversation with Claire, who just reached out to me as someone who had applied for a job and pulled out, and she wanted to know why. And I just think that shows how wonderful she is.
Indeed. And for anybody to find that time to reach out
Well, yeah.
and have a conversation with you in the job when you can so easily just move on to the next thing. So to
Absolutely.
find that time and talk to you about it, it shows what an excellent leader she is.
Oh, she's brilliant.
So you've got one other nice job in your portfolio because
Oh,
you're
yes.
on the board of trustees of the London Transport Museum, which
It's one of
is.
my favourite things to do.
Isn't it just so? As you know, I was indeed twice.
Yes.
When I was outside the organisation, I was an external trustee, and then I moved inside the organisation and became an internal trustee until I ran out of years, which of course is what happened.
Oh.
If you're
I'm worried
not,
about
yeah, I know. Well, Charity Commission is very strong, isn't it, about making sure the trustees are refreshed
Yes.
sufficiently often enough. Nevertheless, London Transport Museum goes from strength to strength during Sam's period, which was 28 years of Sam
Yes.
Mullins. The turnover grew, the visitor numbers grew, the place
It's
is
transformed.
transformed. And isn't it great fun as a trustee? I mean, there's some serious sides to it, of course, but who wouldn't want to be involved in something that people love so much?
Oh, I could talk for hours about how wonderful the museum is. I think it, and it's funny. I was kind of saying to, I say to lots of people that actually the board meetings are some of the best meetings I go to. It's full of people who are so different. Everyone has a voice, and we all sort of support each other, and there's lots of laughter. It's great. And though, yes, there are some serious moments when we kind of get the job done, but we do it in a way that really supports each other, and we kind of, we challenge each other, but we kind of all work together really well, which is lovely. And I think something I absolutely love about the museum, and I find it very odd moving to Network Rail and there isn't a company museum. And I know that sounds really silly, and there's the York Museum, and there's sort of the Steam Museum in Swindon, but there isn't sort of a Network Rail museum. And I find that really odd, because in my first week of being on the graduate scheme at TfL, we all went to the museum, and we all had a day at the museum, and that was one of our induction days. Because I think what's really cool about it is you start at the top, and you kind of, you understand the history of the railway, and you understand why we are here today. You understand why the underground sometimes seems a bit weird, because it was built as competing companies. Like, that's why Paddington and Edgware Road is a nightmare, because it's three competing companies that were actually trying to make life difficult for each other. Like, no wonder it is a bit tricky sometimes. And I think it's so good to get that understanding. I think the museum does the most amazing work to kind of explain that to people. And then you sort of, as you sort of move further down the stairs, you get to the really cool science engineering driving Elizabeth line train, and it's just brilliant. And I think what is sort of not known about the museum so much is the huge amount of charity work it does. And sort of I've been to sort of events where it's working with ex-offenders to get back into the industry. It's enjoyment to employment is one of the schemes they do. So it's sort of, how do you turn that love of, well, first of all, starting to foster the love of transport and the industry, and then moving it into, well, how do you showcase the best of the jobs? And also, like, amazing, the Transport Museum does is that it brings in every, I think it's every single year six or year five or year six child in London to a transport safety workshop. And I've attended a couple in my role as trustee, and I just think it's absolutely brilliant. It teaches people how to behave on the network, how to get their tickets, where do they go, how to cross the road safely. And I just think that is absolutely fabulous. Every child in London gets that. And it's just brilliant. And actually, the museum, sorry, I could talk for hours. And the museum in London I used to take my children to play on the soft play all the time because it was just such a safe place to be.
Indeed.
I
And
loved it.
it is the organization's very best shop window, isn't
Oh
it?
my gosh,
The
yes.
organization at its best, at its most relevant, and all of its historical upbringings and so on. This will amuse you. When the corporate membership scheme was first started, so we're
Yeah.
talking, back in the 1990s, my company was owned by the Chinese. So I took my Chinese chairman and the inevitable posse of 20 other Chinese people who'd come with him to the museum as part of trying to soften him up into agreeing to be, in fact, we became the first corporate sponsor.
Well done.
Anyway, so what was interesting was broadly before most of us had got in, the chairman was on his way out. And I thought, oh, this has gone terribly badly wrong. And so I said to the chairman, he says, fine, we do this, we do this. I said, well, that was very quick. Why so quick? He says, it's very simple. Answers of troubles of today contained in our history.
Oh, yes.
Isn't that powerful? Isn't that
That's
absolutely
so
powerful?
powerful.
And if we think about that, if we unpack some of that, Tesco didn't invent good customer service. We
No.
had good customer service in the 1950s and 1960s. The use of branding, the use of strong logo type, and all the rest of it isn't something that some design agency dreamt up in the 21st century. We had all that back in the 30s and 40s and
Yeah.
so on. And so for me, the museum is this wonderful reminder that our troubles are cyclical and they come
Yes.
round again and again and again. And we learn some lessons, but then the world moves on and so on. So I'm
Yes.
blown away by the fact the museum is as relevant to today as it is about being a container of things from the past.
I agree.
To be fair, it's the story of London from a
It is the
transport
story of
point of
London.
view, which I think is amazing.
Well, I think it's the story of London, but then also sort of as it goes out sort of far as Amersham and sort of Epping, it's London and beyond. And I think the work that Elizabeth Mackay has done since she took over from Sam has just been absolutely incredible. She's sort of taken Sam's legacy and she's just built on different areas. There's such a focus on culture and music, and there's now music every Friday afternoon for a certain number of weeks. And I think it's,
Indeed,
for
and
me,
that.
it's about expanding what there is transport. So I think that people think transport, they think buses, trains, trams, taxis, but it's the art that goes into it. It's all the maquette designs. It's the design into it, there's sort of all the advertising. It's absolutely fascinating. Yeah, I think it's amazing. I saw it interesting about what you said about the history. I've listened to some podcasts recently, not railway related, and two of them talked about the importance of the railway, and one was about World War II and about how they had to keep changing the it's sort of the Germans invaded each country, they had to sort of keep amending to the different track gauges because each different countries had different track gauges, and that really sort of hampered them going. And then another one was about Sudan and South Sudan, and actually it was talking about the importance of the railways in sort of building of nations and moving goods. And I think that there's a really interesting graph. Life expectancy really jumps up from 1985 up to now. You can see that life expectancy has increased with expansion of the railways as you kind of get better access to goods, health, education. And there's so much work that's done around the sort of economic benefits of railways and transport hubs to the local areas. And I think that that's something that the museum does show really well about sort of you can see sort of the expansion of towns as you go around. I just think it's fascinating. And
It
then you
is.
can, by knowing that history, it just enables us to make better decisions going forward.
Without a doubt. And that's why the museum's done a fabulous job. Firstly, it's weaned itself off too much public funding and it's got itself
Yes.
on a self-supporting basis, which is very good, but continues to be the organization's front window. Everything about why things are the way they are and how they got to be there, and the rich culture and the diversity and all that other stuff that we do. And the only sad thing, of course, is that way back in the I think in the 1980s, London Transport, as it then was, had the chance to buy the freehold of that site
Oh,
for not much money, and
that
sadly
would have been
didn't.
glorious.
And that would have been even more amazing. There was a short-sighted decision, if ever there was one.
Yes.
Yeah, just imagine owning that piece of real estate in Covent Garden. So, my guest today has been Sophie Bancroft, who is the HR director at Network Rail. We've had a fabulous conversation through bits of our time together in Transport for London and some of the things we've done similarly, but at different times, and caught up with loads of other stuff as well, which has been tremendous. Lunch with Leon is a podcast that comes to you thanks to Passenger Transport Magazine. Please do check in with passengertransport.co.uk for all your latest passenger transport news. And in the meantime, we'll be back with another episode very soon. And Sophie, thank you very much.
Thank you, Leo. It's been a pleasure.